TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. U.S. Election for President. 2004. Ralph Nader speaks on corporate power and how the non-choice of the lesser of two evils spells the end of democracy. This talk was recorded 3 weeks before the 2004 election on October 11 at the University of California, Berkeley. Zellerbach Hall was filled to capacity with over 2,000 people. You heard the first part of Ralph Nader's speech on the last TUC program. He gave a stunning analysis of the methods by which corporations control our lives, our future, and the political process. Nader said that no other society has allowed corporations to control what their children think, feel, and eat. Even though corporate crime is unprecedented, it remains largely unpunished. And all this is perpetuated by corporate control of the electoral process. In this part of his speech, Nader analyzes what the mantra "anybody but Bush" actually meant. Since the liberal vote was taken for granted, and hardly any organization or individual who endorsed Kerry as the lesser of two evils made any demands on him, John Kerry felt free to make concessions to the right. You are about to hear the long and shocking list of surrenders by Kerry to Bush on issues ranging from the Patriot Act to the conduct of the war in Iraq, where Kerry actually came across, according to the New York Times, as more of a hawk than Bush. Here is Ralph Nader on the lesser of two evils.
The mantra of the liberal wing of the party to Kerry is the following: anybody but Bush, leave Kerry alone, make no demands on him. Therefore, Kerry feels free because he knows he's got the liberal votes. He can take them for granted. They got nowhere to go other than stay home and vote for Kerry. Turns around, and in the debates and before the debates, is taunted into surrendering important issues by George W. Bush, who's really a corporation disguised as a human being in the White House to begin with. Notice. Bush is now taunting him. He taunted him on civil justice, the tort reform bit. This is massive propaganda that is unrebutted by the Democrats, although they vote pretty well on it. But they don't win the battle for public sentiment, as Lincoln once pointed out. And they're losing the battle in public sentiment because people really believe that this great pillar of our democracy, that our forebears fought for, the right of trial by jury, the right to go into the court and plead your case, is out of control. Every day, Bush is hitting at this, Cheney's hitting at this. A flood of litigation. Frivolous lawsuits. It's as if all you got to do in America is cut your finger. You go into a courtroom, the jury gives you $1 million, and the judge says, why so little? 80% of judges in the U.S. were formerly business lawyers. They don't read Karl Marx on their lunch break. They control their court. They control the court. They throw out frivolous suits. Every time I try to get Bush and Senator Frist and others to give me some evidence on frivolous suits, there's never any answer. The press doesn't even ask them. The prevarication level of politics today is such, it's so deep, it's so institutionalized, it's so customized, the press doesn't even ask for any evidence anymore. Bush taunts Kerry on the Patriot Act, says it's got to be renewed. This mass violation of our civil liberties without peer in American history. It's got to be renewed next year and strengthened with Patriot Act 2. So we can have more people arrested without charges, more people imprisoned without lawyers, more material witness suspect put in jail indefinitely without releasing their names. So we can have more intrusion into medical records and your homes and businesses without notifying you. So you can strip, the executive branch can strip the courts of any kind of supervision for probable cause worthy of the name or due process. And what does Kerry say? He says, I voted for the Patriot Act. I support the Patriot Act. I just don't like the way John Ashcroft is enforcing it. Well, first of all, why didn't the Democrats stop John Ashcroft when he was nominated for Attorney General? They knew who he was. He was one of them. And second, what do you mean you don't like the way John Ashcroft enforces? The Patriot Act gave him the tools to do what he's doing. Fortunately, the courts are beginning to overturn some of these. There are about 9 areas where Bush taunted. He had Kerry saying, in effect, read my lips, no federal income tax increase for anyone who makes $200,000 or less. $200,000? Now we're at the $200,000 level? That's 98% of the people make under $200,000. So they're probably told by one of his corporate consultants, let's just say you're going to tax 2% of the people. $200,000 or less? And now he's stuck with it? He's locked himself in on the minimum wage? He wants a gracious increase to $7 an hour by the year 2007? Who in the world can even pay rent with that these days? And he locked him in on his health care plan. Instead of going for health care for all with a single payer system that has quality cost control, free choice of doctor and hospital, extremely efficient, it will cost less than the $6,100 we're spending this year per person for health care when 45 million don't even have it and it's growing, and 25 million don't have enough health care coverage, and the rest who have health care are being told, up your copayments. We have more exclusions, more deductions by the employers who are providing this health care insurance. And he's locked himself in on that. He's locked himself in on Iraq. This is where Bush really has a point. Where is this guy on Iraq called John Kerry? Where is he? First, he votes for an unconstitutional war resolution, shifting the declaration of war authority to the White House. Shades of James Madison and John Adams and others who fought and argued to put the declaration of war by the United States only in the hands of Congress and never in the hands of one man in the White House. They didn't want another King George. Speaking of King George. And this is what Kerry has gone to. First, he votes for the war resolution. Then he says, but it was under the understanding that Bush would go to the UN and Bush would have allies and it would be a last resort. Really? An understanding? You trust Bush with an understanding? Huh? You can't trust Bush with an understanding if you put it on a cue card for him. Understanding? You don't give him the authority in the first place. It's Article 1, Section 8. It stays in Congress. There's never been a longer foreshadowed war in modern times. The drums were beating out of the White House for over a year. It wasn't like a missile attack that we had to respond to. Now look where he is. Now he said it was a mistake to invade Iraq, but he, John Kerry, is going to really mean business. He's going for victory. He's going to attack Fallujah and other cities. He's going to put more troops in. So he's locked himself in already now. Bush is taunting him. He says a few weeks ago to Kerry, if you knew then what you know now, namely, that Saddam Hussein was not connected to al-Qaeda, had no weapons of mass destruction, was not a threat with his dilapidated army that wasn't willing to fight for him, to his neighbors or to the U.S., if you knew then what you know now, what would you have done? And Kerry said I would have done the same thing. Now, after the first presidential debate, he is a hawk. He was welcomed to the realm of hawks by William Safire in the New York Times. He was stunned. He said Kerry was more hawk-like in the first debate than Bush. So now a vote for Kerry is a vote for war. Now, where is the pull factor by the anti-war groups? Those marvelous people had all those rallies in hundreds of cities and towns around the country in 2002 and 2003. They have been muzzled with few exceptions. Muzzled. Medea Benjamin is campaigning for Kerry. Medea Benn, others are campaigning for Kerry. In other words, here's the way it goes. Since Kerry doesn't have to worry about the anti-war movement, because they have followed the mantra, anyone but Bush, leave Kerry alone, make no demands on him, don't pull him into the anti-war withdrawal effort from Iraq, he can just turn his back on these people, say thanks a lot for your coming votes, and try to engage in protective imitation with the messianic militarists in the White House. This is what happens. This is a crisis of liberalism. The environmental groups, you look at their websites, the political arms of the consumer, environmental, labor, minority, anti-poverty, women's, and peace movement. And you see if they make a single pull on Kerry, any pull that is articulated this way, we're thinking of voting for you, but we want you to assure us that you're going to do this and you're going to do that. It's almost zero. That's the crisis of liberalism. They are complicit with making Kerry worse because they're not trying to make him better. And if they made Kerry better, he'd get more votes. You get more votes when you're for a wage that people can live on. You get more votes when you have a good health care plan, not some cockamamie complex plan that doesn't cover everybody in our country the way every other Western democracy does. You get more votes when you show the American people how much their tax dollars are being wasted with corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways, and a bloated, redundant, corrupt military contracting system. You get more votes when you take these savings and bring them back into a public works program that creates great jobs in communities, improving public facilities that cannot be exported to China. By giving Kerry a free ride, you're reducing his vote total. This is my talk to the liberals. You're reducing his vote total. And to see what we call a liberal virus affect some of the finest progressives this country's ever produced in that statement by 70 of our former supporters in 2000, to which Studs Terkel signed, Harvey Wasserman signed, Chomsky signed, Howard Zinn signed, Norman Solomon signed, Cornel West signed. I refuse to believe these are anything but wonderful people, but they've lost their nerve. And in the statement, they proved it. Because in the statement, they said, thank you very much for signers. Thank you. In the statement, here's what they said. These are my former supporters and advisors. Here's what they said. We, the undersigned, urge voters in the close states to vote for John Kerry, although, quote, we strongly disagree with him on the war and other issues, end quote. And then here's what they didn't do. They made no demands on him, number one, no pull. Number two, they didn't even have the decency to say to the voters in the safe states, you know, the ones like Texas for Bush, New York for Kerry, California for Kerry, to vote for the Nader-Kamejo ticket. They didn't even say that. And finally, when they signed off, there wasn't a single caveat for the Kerry-Edwards ticket. No conditionality. It was a permanent stand for Kerry-Edwards in the safe states. How do you interpret something like that, other than a loss of nerve? Do you know now that Kerry doesn't have to worry about Chomsky? Zinn? Doesn't have to worry about these people who have piercingly analyzed power in America and excoriated the Democratic as well as the Republican Party? This is the politics of fear at work. And if you succumb to the politics of fear, you will be fearful. And if you're fearful, you will not be courageous. And if you're not courageous, you will not have high expectation levels. You will not lead the country into the future. For heaven's sake, if you're going to support Kerry, make him better. Make him respect your vote. Hold your vote dear. Because the corporate interests are just doing that in the other direction. Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist. Oh, if we had orators like him. He said something before the Civil War. It's one of those eternal phrases. Power concedes nothing without a demand. I would add the following. You should never put the struggle for justice on adjournment. You should never send the struggle of justice on vacation, ever, because the forces of injustice never go on vacation. They never are on adjournment. You owe this to the young generation, because a four-year cycle after four-year cycle goes by least worst with the progressive agenda on the shelf. No wonder the young generation can't even make an argument for the graduated income tax or for the estate tax. And some can't even make an argument for Social Security. They think savings accounts in the stock market, otherwise known as social insecurity, are the preferred mode. We owe it to young generation to show them how they can take control in this country in four-year election cycles. Because it's their country. 2,000-plus weeks, you're 65. And those weeks are going to go very quickly. And your 20s are very creative. It's the most of your creative decade. You may be more wise, better judgment, more experience later. The 20s are when you're going to break ground, smash the paradigm, turn the vector, create. You've got to be very careful because our culture makes a mess out of your 20s. Don't waste your 20s trying to get over personal problems you should have solved when you were an adolescent. Don't allow yourself to be trivialized. Don't allow yourself to go for the least worst. You go for the least worst in one area, you'll go for the least worst in a lot of areas because you'll be lowering your expectation level, which is the ultimate controlling process of power structures. As long as they lower expectation levels, they got you. You have to develop in university a public philosophy. What's your role as a public citizen? You know what you're going to be as a private citizen. You're going to try to get a good job, raise a family, enjoy yourself, have some retirement security. What about your public responsibilities? Someone knocked on your door tomorrow and said, "Hi, I'm your new neighbor. Just thought I'd introduce myself. I spend 22% of your income. Can increase your taxes, can allow others to expose you to toxic waste, and can send you off to war. See you later." What would you say? "What are you doing bothering me? I was watching the third rerun of Cheers." That's your member of Congress. And here's the ultimate monopolistic of American politics. That not only have the corporations pulled both parties so that the similarities between them tower over the dwindling real differences that they're willing to struggle over, but they've now moved these two parties into a kind of redistricting where the duopoly thrusts for monopoly, the two-party duopoly. So now they're redistricting the country, congressional redistricting, state legislative redistricting, so that one party dominates overwhelmingly one district and the other party dominates another district, depending on who controls the state legislature and the governor. You know what this has done? Right before our eyes. Your metabolism won't go up one inch when I tell you this, compared to an ethnic or gender slur that you could be exposed to. Watch this. 95% of the voters in the United States who vote for their representatives in the House of Representatives have only the incumbent. It's a coronation. The opposing party, Democrat or Republican, has conceded the district because of the redistricting failure and either has no one on the other side of the line on the ballot or just a nominal candidate. Some accountant wants to get his name in the paper for a few weeks. Everybody knows who's going to win. You go down and vote, it's a coronation. Here in California, only one member of the House lost. His name was Gary Condon. That's what he had to do to lose. Every other member of the House, Republican, Democrat, won in a landslide. The closest race here in California for a House seat in Washington was 59 to 41. That's the closest. That's the end of elections. Forget it. Forget the myth. Elections require at least two people. Otherwise, we're being criminalized. Two people, at least. Chile has 10 parties. Norway has 14 parties. Germany has parties. Canada has at least five functioning parties that get on the prime minister debates before an election. We're now down to one party. At the state legislative level, it's a mockery. In Massachusetts, 60% of the state legislators running for re-election next month have no opponent. Others, just nominal opponent. Nationwide, it's 40%, and it's only getting worse. These trends of corporate power are dynamic. They're going to be worse 3 years from now than they are now. They're relentless. They have crushed the opposition. The opposition used to be government to some degree. It used to be regulatory agencies. It used to be courts. It used to be trade unions. It used to be custom. Just things you shouldn't do as a company, like exploit children. And these defenses have been crumbling, and the relentless drive is accelerating. And as a result, look at the decline of our standard of living. The economy has doubled in 25 years, GDP, leaving most people behind. Just look at the poverty in this state. Call up Robert Felmuth, professor of law, University of San Diego Law School, who is the leading child advocate here in California. He'll show you how 46% of the children in California are in two categories, poverty and near poverty, 46%. One out of every three workers here makes Walmart wages. You got Walmart coming into the state, and supermarkets and hotels and others are saying, we got to cut wages. We got to cut benefits. That's what the strikes are about, cutting health benefits and wages and pensions. It's going backwards. Our fuel efficiency is going backwards. It's the lowest for the new vehicle fleet since 1980. The amount of consumer debt per capita has never been higher. The level of corporate crime has never been greater. The corruption of our government has never been more quantitatively devastating. Your metabolism doesn't go up, means you don't have a civic personality. A civic personality absorbs abstractions rooted in reality and responds. And that's what we have to do in this election. And in California, Kerry's going to carry it. Bush isn't even campaigning here. It's over. That means you can vote your conscience. That means you can vote for candidates you think represent your futures. Candidates who will zero in on sharp tuition increases, on no health insurance when you graduate, if you're lucky enough, unless you're lucky enough to have an employer who provides it, on the military draft, on the failed war on drugs, on. That's what the write-in is about. And that's what we have to deal with in a very specific manner. How many of you have heard of Eugene Debs? Okay. He said something, and so did Cicero. Cicero said, freedom is participation in power. That's one you never forget. By that definition, how much freedom do we have? Participation in power. But Debs said he'd rather vote for a candidate he believes in who loses than a candidate he doesn't believe in who wins. And why did he say that? Because the history of social justice movements is one of losing and fighting until you win. That's what the 19th century parties did with their movements, abolishing slavery and women's right to vote and the trade union, labor party, and the populist progressive parties. They never won a national election. But it's because enough voters did not go least worst between the Democrats and the Whigs or the Democrats and the Republicans. They went for these parties because they believed in those social justice platforms. that we got those social justices established far earlier and with far less bloodshed than we would have otherwise. And the second comment Debs made, and by the way, half of democracy is just showing up, just showing up to meetings, to rallies, to city council gatherings, to the polls, to the courts, showing up. Here's what he said. Must have been very disappointing to have him say this. He said, quote, "The American people can have anything they want, but it seems that they don't want much of anything at all when it comes to election day." Thank you.
That was the second half of a one-hour speech by Ralph Nader. He was recorded at the University of California, Berkeley Zellerbach Hall, 3 weeks before the U.S. presidential elections of 2004. Ralph Nader, trained as a lawyer, first made headlines when he wrote the book Unsafe at Any Speed. General Motors hired detectives to discredit him. They failed. Nader went on to form an organization of energetic lawyers, often called Nader's Raiders. They produced systematic exposés of industrial hazards, pollution, unsafe products, and governmental neglect. Nader played a key role in the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and the Freedom of Information Act. Among the organizations that he founded are the Center for Auto Safety, Public Citizen, the Clean Water Project, and the Multinational Monitor. You can find more information on Ralph Nader and Peter Camejo on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's TUC Radio.org. Look under newest programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get a 90-minute tape or CD of the talk by Ralph Nader and Peter Camejo by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 1-877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8272. 7-3. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.